Accession number 10167, Reel 10.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 10. What happened after the rest period at Montefiore?
We did at that stage go back into action, and there were one or two battles. But nothing that I remember that was very remarkable. Things continued much about the same way, except to the extent that we were becoming more and more low in morale. And then suddenly we were pulled out. And it starts off this sort of thing where you're pulled back to an immediate sting area. And then you're pulled even further back. And then rumours start to develop that there must be something in the air. You begin to appreciate that this is not an immediate rest. This is something rather different. And, of course, everyone's morale improves then remarkably. We pulled quite a way back, and I don't think we were very far from Rome, because some people went in there for a break, and then were called back suddenly. And one of our signalers, a dry character called Frankie Mason, reckoned that he was about to have a prostitute when he was dragged away back to the battalion, which may or may not be true. We were, somewhat dramatically for us, put onto aeroplanes and flown out to Athens in Dakotas. And we were then pushed into a completely different situation. I'll sort of put the political bit next, I think. The Elas, who were communist-inspired, were, I guess at that point in time, trying to take advantage of the war situation by taking over the seats of power and control in Greece. And we had been sent out to, I suppose, pacify the situation and restore the status quo. And this all happened rather quickly, and that was why we were sent out, I think, with the foresters. It was probably about a brigade strength, truthfully. And it was controlled by a brigadier block, and it became known as Block Force as a sort of a group. We start with all of the army by that time was pretty well socialist. Everyone was of the view that the conservatives were to blame for all sorts of ills that we had in the war and the general level of the economy of the country and the way that people felt about the future. So that by and large they were all pretty well Labour, and this came out in the 45 election later on. And even though I think people admired Churchill for his ability to lead the country, his politics were completely suspect. He was conservative and was blackened with the rest of the conservatives. So that we sort of felt that what the government was trying to do in Greece was to restore the monarchy, which we also surmised was really not what the people wanted, but this was going to be imposed upon them. Therefore, in the beginning, there was a fair amount of favourable feeling towards this insurgency, which sort of later changed, as it tends to do, I think. Anyway, we arrived in Athens towards the night and were almost immediately put out into more or less tactical positions.
This was December 1944.
December 1944, about December the 3rd, I think I've got the date down. And in my childhood, I'd always been reading the classics, and the thought of going to Athens was something quite remarkable to me, and something that I thought I should never have been able to take advantage of. And one of the companies that night was placed on the Acropolis itself. And I remember the next morning, nothing much happened, there were sort of shots going off all over the place. And I said to the signaller at, I think it was Charlie Company, "How was it, Tony?" It was Tony Sacco. And he said, "Nothing else but bloody stones up here, and it's freezing cold." And I thought, well, you know, that's the practical view of what the Acropolis was like. The position was very, very confused. The enemy were just the same as any other Greeks, as far as we knew. They didn't have any uniform as such. So there's always this problem of knowing who they were. And if someone shot at you and had a rifle, then you shot at him back, sort of thing. But what tended to happen was that you took their rifles away from them, probably quite often just let them go free, and then they turn around and start firing at you again. So in a way, although people were quite glad to be away from the main battlefront, and it certainly wasn't as hard as fighting the Germans, it was a situation which was quite completely different to the way we'd been used to fighting, that there were aspects of it that people felt uneasy about. Your average infantryman, one of the first questions that you ask when you go into a new battle position is which way is the front, so that you know, if the worst comes to the worst, which way you can go to get out of the bloody place. Now, in this sort of situation, which is a typical urban battlefront, it's all around you, and one feels somewhat unhappy about that, because there's no sort of clear-cut way. And fighting in the man's houses and so forth was not really the sort of warfare that we've been used to. So that for a while, that's really what it boiled down to. And there was one interesting little story. We were in this house which we'd taken over. There was a bit of shooting going on, and the object of the exercise was to pacify the sort of situation and take guns away from people. We were in this company headquarter house, which was totally furnished, a lovely room, all sorts of ornament and bric-a-brac and so forth, and a beautiful old musical box which they had on the sideboard. In the room with us were brigade signallers. Brigade signallers were Royal Corps signals, and they operated usually from battalion headquarters back to brigade, so we hardly ever saw them. But we had them with us because at that time we were acting really as the battalion headquarters and as a signals communication centre. So these two Royal Corps signals had very little experience of any sort of action at all. Anyway, the officer commanding was Captain Sherlow, Ronnie Sherlow, and he came in at one time. Things were desultory, there were just sort of minor actions going on. And he brought in a Luger, which they'd just taken off somebody, and put it on the sideboard. Well, we weren't terribly interested in guns. Our view of guns was that if you weren't too careful, they went off and somebody got hurt. So, but he said, "Don't touch that bloody thing, it's loaded, you know." But the Royal Corps people, who hadn't really much experience of this sort of thing, were terribly interested in this gun. And we were working, and they were working off and on, sending messages backwards and forwards. We used to go over and keep looking at it. And we said, "Leave the bloody thing alone." Anyway, they didn't. And at one time when we were busy, one of them must have picked it up, and he fired it, and a shot rang out. And the musical box started to play, and we couldn't get it to stop. And we hadn't really taken over this house. We'd only sort of borrowed it, so we weren't trying to make too much damage to it. Anyway, we thought that the bullet had lodged in the musical box, But there wasn't a sign of it. And there wasn't a sign of it anyway. Ronnie Sherlock came in and was very annoyed where things were going. And we said, well, it wasn't us, it was us, because we were there, we did it. Anyway, we carried on working, kept looking for this, places where the bullet might have gone to, but there wasn't any sign of it. So we surmised it was just a mystery at that point in time. And then later on, about lunchtime, the cooks had come up. And they in the courtyard had set up all their cooking paraphernalia, made a right mess, as they usually did. But anyway, around about midday, they'd got themselves some hot stew, which was ready. And when we were all sort of mucking in together, Ronnie Sherlow and the rest of us, and company, of course, we were all sort of on the same terms. There wasn't any question of rank. You just sort of all mucked in together. But we watched him out the corner of our eye coming in on this occasion, and he was surreptitiously getting his mess tins out of his rucksack so he could be the first in the queue for gruffy. And when he took his mess tins out, he said, bloody hell, and there was a hole right through his mess tins. When they'd fired the gun, it had gone right along the floor and gone right into his rucksack and through his mess tins. So that was what had happened to the gun and to the bullet. Anyway...
You signallers had a sort of non-combatant attitude, you told me before.
Yeah.
Did you see enough to know anything about the tactics or the methods used of trying of the street fighting or trying to maintain order?
We saw bits of it. What was happening, this was in the very beginning, was a totally confused state of affairs. We didn't have any line. Later on we had a line that we were sort of trying to defend. Later, we were, in fact, protecting the road from Piraeus, which is the port area of Athens, to Athens itself. But here we were just in various strong points, and were being, or we were attacking other houses that had Aelas in them, so it was really a question of when you came under fire, you attacked a particular house, flushed out anybody that was in there, took them prisoner or whatever, took their guns off them, and then... You just sort of hung around and waited until the next little bit of flare-up. So it really wasn't terribly organised at that point in time. But I think by about another week, we had got ourselves more or less into a battle line position. And the object of the exercise, we had people, I think it was the foresters or one other of the battalions in the brigade, were in the Piraeus area. And the organised Aelas troops were trying to cut off the road and separate and isolate Athens from the port because, you know, most supplies would come in from the port. So at that point in time, it was really more or less a more organised battle in that we were defending the road and in houses along the road from attacks by Aelas. So that tended to be fairly straightforward. A little bit later on, we...
Did they... You say from attacks, what sort of attack would they make?
At that point in time, it would be fairly formal. It was more like guerrilla attacks, small bands, perhaps 20 or 30, would make attack, perhaps at night. They also had dynamite, which they tended to use. A little bit later on, this just shows how really desperate it got. They blew, I think, a door down where battalion headquarters were. Now, battalion headquarters, you know, normally would be very far away from trouble. So they got quite annoyed at all the cooks and the clerks and things when they found that they were in the middle of the battle for some reason or other. And they used dynamite quite a bit. At other times, and this happened a little bit later on, the Aelas tended to use women. They'd have women coming along the street, just as though they were housewives, having a demonstration even, followed by armed men behind them, using the women as a shield, you see, or even children, having children around so you couldn't fire at them. So it got very dirty in that sense. And this is about the time that, as it will always happen in these situations, where the soldier's attitude changed from being politically favourable to being militarily against them, because, you know, they weren't, in our sense, playing particularly fair. And before very long, it was just that they were them and we were us, and it was just a combat situation. And I think we tended to feel eventually that they were communist, and really probably weren't out to do any more for the population of Greece. And later on we did, talking to the ordinary population, that they weren't particularly supported by the ordinary men in the street, in a sense that they were in an opposing political position, as would have been the royalists. If you are surmising that Churchill was trying to reimpose the king, George, I think it was, the communists were trying to impose communist rule, so that really, in effect, one was almost as bad as the other. And we were somewhere in between, I guess.
How far did they push the attacks when they attacked? I mean, did the battalion suffer many casualties?
Yes.
Or were positions overrun? Or?
The positions were overrun. There was one situation I remember where people were in a house and the guerrillas took the bottom floors of the house, and these people were upstairs isolated, and they had to chop a hole in the floor to get out. I mean, all sorts of silly little things like that happened, but quite a number of people were killed, not to the same extent as it would be in a straightforward battle in Italy, but, you know, a fair number of odd casualties. But they couldn't really sustain all-out attacks. It was more just a quick in-and-out sort of thing. They would come along, blow up a hole in us, kill one or two people, and then go off again. I mean, they really didn't have much in the way of a standing army. It was what I would imagine be a typical guerrilla-type war. Smash-and-grab sort of thing.
The battalion's morale was pretty bad, you said. How did it respond to this different sort of threat, this sort of thief-in-the-night approach?
I don't think they were too low at that point in time. It was different, and they didn't like it very much. But they all sensed that, well, it must be marginally better than being fighting the Germans, who everyone had the most sound respect for. We thought that this lot were comic opera, in a sense, you know, that if you applied sufficient strength and could get to them in a straightforward one-to-one situation, you usually won.
What sort of
I don't know that, in general, I would say that they didn't rate very high in terms of military ability.
What sort of contacts did you have with the Greek civilians? Were you allowed out or freely, or did you have precautions?
Well, we were out with them, but it was very difficult because you could never tell whether they were sort of ELAS supporters or not. Later on we did, and we met them, and we got on very well with them, actually. Odd people, the Greeks, though, you know, they're very difficult to get too close to. But generally, afterwards, when it was all over, they were very, very good to us, and we sort of gained the feeling that the ELAS didn't really have any strong support amongst the ordinary people.
During the bit when the fighting was going on, were you restricted in your movements? Were you, for instance, did you have to go out in?
You didn't go out much at all, really, in the beginning. Later on, the situation seemed to quieten down, and I might mention that when we went out, I was allocated to A Company, and I was with A Company at this moment in time. And just to sort of go back in time a little, all of the real experienced signalers out at companies tended to be always at companies, because, you know, I suppose it makes sense that you are somebody who you know can do the job, battle trained, and doesn't let you down. But we never, most of us, tend to meet our people that we felt some sort of relationship with, that we felt we had a strong bond with all the signalers who were at the sharp ends rather than those who were always in B echelon in the base. But we never often met because we were usually quite some distance apart, except when companies passed one another. And when we did meet, when we were in rest positions where we did go back to become a signal platoon, all of the experienced ones, all of the company signalers, tended to get on very well together and have a good time. And the ones that I always got on as well as any with were Frank Mason and Walter Webley, but they always tended to be in another company. But on this occasion, for some strange reason, they put all three of us together in A Company. And apart really from a bit of battle experience, we had a good time, actually, because we got on as friends together. And it was really the first time that we were able to take advantage of it. Frank Mason was a dry old stick, a very, very witty. And Walter was a cockney. And we three, as I say, had a right old time. And on one occasion, things were fairly static. And we were just in some houses. The company were occupying these houses. And the front line was over the other side of the street, technically. But there wasn't any obvious signs of anyone being there. And just on the opposite side of the road was this wine shop. So we used to make sorties over there for wine. They had I remember at the time we were very keen on banana wine, and they had this thing going for banana wine. So when things were quiet, no one was looking, we used to hop over there and buy ourselves some banana wine. By this time, Ronnie Shaler had left us, and we had Alan Hay, who was a bluff, hearty old character, who's very strong now in the association. Anyway, he came along and saw us quaffing this banana wine, and he asked us what the devil we were doing, where we'd got from. We told him, and he was aghast. He said, "You're not to go over there again, you know, you killed that front line over there." So we said, "Well, you know, we should try this, it's good stuff." So he had a drink of that, and he coughed around a bit and said, "Well, if you ever get any more, you can get some from me." That was the way it was. It was an odd sort of a half war, if you like. And in between whiles, when things were quiet, we had quite a good time. Yeah. Because we were all very experienced signalers, and he hadn't been very long in the job. And we made a good job, really, of keeping him on the lines that we thought that he ought to be. So we tended to do very well.
That seems to have been the relationship with most of your officers at the company headquarters.
Yeah.
First name terms and very friendly.
Yeah, whilst you're in sort of battle situations, they, you know, we were just sort of more or less a man-to-man terms and friendship.
Did you think they were competent?
The thing was that afterwards, of course, if you got in a rest situation, bullshit came back, then the position completely changed, which it was bound to. But you didn't like that particular, you know, because obviously it worked rather better when you could just sort of be friendly with people without having to be too aware on the army relationships involved.
Did you think the officers were
some were more competent than others? Ronnie Shaler was a good officer, very competent. Alan Hay was a bit of a bullshitter and a braggart and not very clever, but he was lucky in that. He was, I think, in the beginning, of course, just a platoon officer and had been wounded. So I don't really know whether he had a lot of experience. And in Athens, it really wasn't too important. And as I say, we tried to keep him doing the right things. We used to offer our bits of advice as to all the officers as to what they should do. Most of them didn't take any heed, of course, because it was gratuitous. But
what about the NCOs? Did you see much of them?
In the headquarters? With us, we would have the company sergeant major. And some of them were very good, because they are the sort of people around whom the strength of the infantry companies and battalions really depend. The sergeants are the very crux of how good any competent unit is, because they are the link between the officers, who may or may not be good, and are mostly quite transitory. Second lieutenants fighting don't last very long, because they tend to be up forward with their platoons, and, you know, the mortality rate was quite high amongst second lieutenants. Sergeants were the ones who had a bit more battle experience, kept themselves out of trouble, but they were the ones who improved morale, kept people doing what they ought to do, and were able to provide the backbone to keep the men morale up, and of course giving them advice upon what to do and where to go, and most of the officers tended, not unnaturally, to rely very much upon the strength of their sergeants, their corporals, to a limited extent.
Would you have, this company sergeant major, would you have much to do with him as company signallers?
No, not really. He was more or less looking after the welfare of the ordinary men in the company as such. As I explained, we were a bit surplus in the sense that we were attached to them, strictly speaking. There was ourselves and the stretcher bearers who were much in that same sort of capacity, and the stretcher bearers certainly regarded themselves as non-combatants, and we did with much less realism. Anyway,
how long you were in Athens, and then you went out to hold the line at, on the Piraeus Road?
Yes, and then we came back to Athens again, and things started to stabilise. The position we were tending really to able to impose our will upon the area.
What about when you went out and to Patras?
Well, I think about January the 6th. Things had quietened down in Athens. The battle had largely been won. And I think by the 14th there was a general truce throughout the country. But probably a week before that, we had won the battle in Athens. But over in other parts of the country, there were still large concentrations of ELAS troops, and they were in control. So before then, January the 6th, we went out from Athens to Patras in LSTs. And I think we went right round Greece as far as I remember. I don't think the Corinth Canal was sort of free then, which was quite a bloody journey, because these were big landing craft that were utilised for landing tanks. And they had front. They were rather like the ferries. They had flat fronts, and they had the front came down and the tanks came out. So the front and the whole ship used to buck up and down. And Walter Webley, I remember, was non-competent all the time that we were at sea. Absolutely hopeless. He couldn't eat a thing. And he lay. We had a table where we used to eat, and he lay under the table all the journey, and we used to sit there with our feet on top of him and say, do you want any to eat, Walter? No, all right. I was all right. Used to have a stronger stomach in those days than I have now. Anyway, we got to Patras, which is a small coastal port on the other side, the western side of Greece. And it was just the battalion that went out there. Although, no, I think there were two of those. I think the Leicesters were out there as well, so there must be two battalions. They went inland. We went straight into Patras in the beginning. Confused situation again. The last were supposed to be around, but they weren't in the town as far as I remember. We went into a flower factory for our first barracks, as it were, which happened to be next to the brothel. And they immediately put the brothel out of bounds, which is not surprising. And we kept coming out of Patras and coming back to this place, so we had quite a lot of activity in Patras over the time. But what tended to happen was that the ELAS were in the countryside in gangs, terrorizing the locals, who were all afraid to do very much against them. So we had to go out, usually in company strength, to various villages around and about the area, go out and just pacify the area, take any weapons that we could find off groups of people that may happen to have them. And then when it was quiet again, we would tend to come back.